From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Having invaded Iraq, Bush and his hawks are now getting ready to go for regime change in Tehran.
First it was Iraq, now Iran. We're joined by Middle East expert Dilip Hero as Washington sets its sights on the second member of the so-called Axis of Evil. A new report reveals the Bush administration had planned to invade Iraq as early as December, as it continued to tell the American people war is the last option. And we'll talk to a former Army Ranger who has just published a book of remixed war posters.
Yeah, the imagery that you see today on shows like Fox News is almost identical to the 1940s propaganda.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld has suggested publicly for the first time Iraq may have destroyed its weapons of mass destruction before the U.S. invaded. Rumsfeld has repeatedly said it's just a matter of time before these weapons will be found in Iraq. Meanwhile, the Guardian of London reports the good news for the Pentagon is that its investigators have finally unearthed evidence of weapons of mass destruction, including 100 vials of anthrax and other dangerous bacteria. The bad news is that the stash was found not in Iraq, but fewer than 50 miles from Washington near Fort Detrick in Maryland. The anthrax is a non-virulent strain, and the discoveries are apparently remnants of an abandoned germ warfare program. Interestingly, there is no documentation about the biological agents disposed of at the U.S. Biodefense Center at Fort Detrick. In the run-up to the invasion of Iraq, U.S. officials said Iraq's failure to come up with paperwork proving the destruction of its biological arsenal was evidence of deception. The London Guardian's reporting, in the months before the U.S. invasion of Iraq, the Pentagon ignored repeated warnings that it would need a substantial military police force immediately after the invasion to provide law and order. This, according to U.S. government advisors. Some 4,000 U.S. military police are now being deployed in Baghdad, but only after most Iraqi government services have been crippled by a wave of rioting and looting and arson. According to The Guardian, the anarchy in the streets was predicted by several panels of former ambassadors, soldiers, and peacekeeping experts who advised the Pentagon and the White House while the invasion was being planned. They urged that lessons be learned from previous U.S.-led military interventions and a post-conflict police force must be established before the war. Most U.S. military police are reservists who are given just one day's instruction in dealing with civilian crowds, and the U.S. Army Peacekeeping Institute is being closed in September. Saudi Arabian officials have arrested five men suspected of involvement in the suicide attacks on residential compounds in Riyadh. An unnamed source told Reuters that the officials believe one of the suspects was the mastermind behind the attacks. The source also said the arrests were made in the Muslim holy city of Medina. On May 12th, bombers hit three residential compounds known to house Westerners. 34 people were killed. The Supreme Court yesterday ruled 6-3 state workers can sue their employers for violating the Family and Medical Leave Act. The law entitles the workers to take up to 12 weeks of unpaid leave for work for several reasons, including birth or adoption or a family emergency. The court extended the protections of the federal law to almost 5 million state employees. The ruling breaks with the court's recent tradition of siding with states against the federal government involving the extension of federal anti-discrimination laws. Women's rights groups hailed the ruling. However, the Supreme Court yesterday refused to hear an appeal of a federal court decision that upheld the Bush administration policy of holding secret deportation hearings for hundreds of foreign nationals detained after September 11th. The appeal was brought by a group of New Jersey newspapers that argued the public has a need to know how the government is responding to the 911 attacks. We'll have more on that in the other hour of Democracy Now! Also yesterday, the Supreme Court ruled a police sergeant did not violate the rights of a seriously injured farm worker by interrogating him at the hospital without reading him his Miranda rights. In 1997, Oxnard, California police shot Oliverio Martinez five times and then subjected him to a lengthy interrogation while he awaited medical treatment. According to a transcript of the interview, Martinez told the police officer, quote, "I am choking. I am dying. Please." The officer replied, "If you're going to die, tell me what happened." Martinez was left blind and paralyzed. Dissenting Justice John Paul Stevens compared the interrogation to, quote, "an attempt to obtain an involuntary confession from a prisoner by torturous methods." The Miranda warnings begin with, "You have the right to remain silent." This ruling means police officers cannot be sued for failing to read someone these rights. Martinez may still be allowed to collect damages on the grounds that his constitutional due process rights were violated. The Archbishop of Canterbury and other Anglican church leaders said yesterday they cannot support ceremonies blessing gay partnerships. Issuing a statement from a meeting in Brazil, the church leaders said the issue is divisive and there is no theological consensus on the issue. The controversy intensified recently when a bishop in Vancouver approved blessing rituals for gay men and lesbians. More than 100 non-governmental organizations from around the world have issued an Evian water challenge to leaders of the group of eight major industrial nations that will meet next week in Evian, France. The challenge demands that the G8 nations stop pressuring developing countries to privatize their water resources. The European Union has been especially aggressive in this effort. The EU is demanding that 72 countries open their water sectors to foreign private investment in the world trade negotiations. This would greatly benefit the six major multinational corporations, which account for virtually all private investment in water utilities in developing countries. They include the France's Suez and Vivendi Environment Corporations, as well as Bechtel. Bechtel is the U.S. company that won the first major reconstruction contract in Iraq.
Living in the wasteland of the free. We got preachers dealing in politics and diamond mines.
Iris Dement singing Wasteland of the Free here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld warned Iran yesterday that the U.S. would, quote, aggressively put down any attempt to install a theocratic regime in Iraq. The warning reflects Washington's concern that some Shia Muslim clerics in Iraq with political and religious ties to Iran will help to fill the vacuum left by the fall of Saddam Hussein. This, according to the Financial Times. In recent weeks, Washington has taken a more hardline stance towards Iran, one of the members of the so-called Axis of Evil. The Washington Post reports the Bush administration appears set to call for the destabilization of the Iranian government. The Pentagon is urging President Bush to approve public and private actions that could lead to the toppling of the government. The Pentagon plan may involve the Iraq-based armed opposition movement Mujahideen Khalq, even though it's designated a terrorist group by the U.S. State Department. On Monday, the Iranian opposition group, the National Council of Resistance of Iran, said it had evidence of two previously undisclosed uranium enrichment facilities west of Tehran. This comes as the Bush administration tries to build international support for the International Atomic Energy Agency to look further into Iran's nuclear program. The U.S. also canceled diplomatic talks with Iran and accused the country of failing to take action against members of al-Qaeda. An unnamed Bush administration official told the Los Angeles Times that last weekend's talks in Geneva were scrapped because the U.S. has information linking the attacks in Saudi Arabia to operatives in Iran. The Saudi foreign minister, Prince Saud al-Faisal, said he believes Iran would cooperate with any request for the extradition of suspected Saudi members of al-Qaeda wanted in connection with the bombings. Accounts in the Arab press report that Saad bin Laden, the son of al-Qaeda's founder, operates out of Iran. The U.S. also believes the new head of al-Qaeda's military operations, Saif al-Adl, is living in Iran near the Afghan border. We go now to Britain, to Dilip Hero, journalist and author of many books, including Iraq in the Eye of the Storm. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Dilip.
Thank you.
It's good to have you with us. Well, can you lay out the latest, particularly first responding to Donald Rumsfeld warning Iran that the U.S. will, quote, aggressively put down any attempt to install a theocratic regime in Iraq?
Yeah, I think that this threat seems to be rather fanciful because the question of doing it aggressively, what does the word aggressive mean? The point is very simple, that anybody who knows anything about Iraq knows that 60% of Iraqis are Shiite. And in Iran, 87% are Shiite. So certainly Shiites, whether they are in Iran or Iraq, feel some kind of a bond. Secondly, something which Mr. Rumsfeld should really catch up on, that there was an Iran-Iraq war for 8 years, 1988. In fact, it was during that war. You remember Mr. Rumsfeld had a 90-minute talk with this terrible man, Saddam Hussein, and Saddam had used chemical weapons against the Iranians in October 1983, and during Rumsfeld's meeting with Saddam Hussein in December, 83, he did not raise this point. The fact is that during that war, 500,000 Iraqi Shiites voluntarily migrated or left or fled or escaped from Iraq to go and live in Iran. And of course, if you allow for natural growth of these people, they married, etc., etc., so there are, at the time of the starting of invasion of Iraq by the Anglo-American forces, there were 750,000 Iraqi Shiites who were in Iran, and many of them have now returned to the country because Saddam Hussein, whom they hated, is gone. So if they, and of course the Supreme Council of Iraq, Islamic Revolution in Iraq, which, by the way, is a recognized group by the Bush administration, of which Mr. Rumsfeld, I think, is still a cabinet member, they are saying that Iraq is for Iraqis, and we have to decide our future. Now, who is Mr. Rumsfeld to tell them that you can't have theocracy? And let me put it the other way around. Suppose tomorrow the U.S. Congress and the three-quarters of the states of America decide to become Christian theocracy. Would Britain or Germany or France say you can't have it, Christian theocracy? Of course you can have. You can change the Constitution if three-quarters of the 50 states of the USA agree to do that. So who is Mr. Rumsfeld telling Iraqis who are now free, free to do what? Free to exercise self-determination. And who gave the idea of self-determination? Again, Mr. Rumsfeld, who, as you know, is a major in political science, he should reread American history. It was Woodrow Wilson, President Woodrow Wilson, who came up with the idea of self-determination for nations. So the point is, the giving these threats to Iran makes no sense, because the people who are involved here, Iraqi Shias, returning home. Secondly, the Supreme Council of Islamic Revolution in Iraq is recognized by the U.S. government. So what's this whole thing about Iran doing things aggressively?
Do you believe that the U.S. would attack Iran?
Yes, I think you see, we have been here before. If you had asked me this question before the 20th of March, I would have said we don't know. But now we know exactly what happened. We have gone through this particular pattern. What was the basis on which a sovereign country of Iraq was invaded? This was not a war on Iraq. It was invaded by the Anglo-American forces. There were two reasons. One, that Saddam has weapons of mass destruction. And two, that Saddam is in league with Al-Qaeda, which is the international terrorist organization. Now, as you know and I know, by now, Americans and the British have been in Iraq since 20th of March, more than 2 months. They have found zero weapons of mass destruction. Regarding Al-Qaeda-Saddam link, yes, they found some papers which showed that at the very low level, there were meetings and somebody went to Baghdad at a very low level. This was what you may call a preliminary contracts, which never went any further. And finally, now that we have the British troops sitting in Basra, what have they discovered, among other things? They have found in Basra, city of 1.25 million, there were 150 liquor stores. 150 liquor stores in a city of only about 1.25 million. Now, how do you expect Bin Laden, who is a fanatic Muslim who loathes the idea of alcohol, how would you expect somebody like Bin Laden to have anything to do, have a link with Saddam Hussein, in whose regime liquor was being sold openly, as I gave you the example of in Basra? So what I'm simply saying is that we have been here before. We were given a pack of lies on 2 points. One, that Saddam has weapons of mass destruction, which you haven't found yet. And secondly, Saddam was in league with Al-Qaeda. Now, the one point that I made then, which I don't think many people even noticed, what I said then, this was in December when I was there to promote my book, Iraq in the Eye of the Storm, that if Bush and company want to show that Saddam is in league with terrorists, there's an organization whose name is Mujahideen-e-Khalq Organization, MKO. Now, the Mujahideen-e-Khalq Organization was put on the list of terrorist organizations by the U.S. State Department in October 1997. Now, Mujahideen-e-Khalq Organization have had their headquarters in central Baghdad since 1987. When I visited Baghdad, I have seen their headquarters. It's a four-story building with a lot of antennas, and just across the street is a hotel called Swan Lake Hotel. Now, if Bush and company wanted to show that Saddam is in league with terrorists, all they had to say was, listen, this government has the headquarters of Mujahideen-e-Khalq Organization, which is on our terrorist list in central Baghdad, and therefore Saddam is helping terrorist organizations. In fact, you see, they were receiving monies from the training from the Iraqi army, and of course, what was their job? Their job was to have pinprick attacks on Iran. They, at one point, actually, their supporters in central Tehran fired rockets at the offices of the president and the supreme leader of Iran. So the point is simply, if it's a question of proving that, Saddam was with terrorists, then they should have said the same thing about the MKO. In fact, you earlier mentioned National Council of Resistance. Would you believe that NCR was put on the list of terrorist organizations after 9/11? But do you know, they still have an office in Washington, D.C. Their office is in the same building as the press club in the northwest Washington, D.C. So, I don't understand how come organizations which are on the terror list are openly functioning in the USA while Rumsfeld and his fellow hawks are making noises about Iran.
De La Pirro, I want to ask you about Saif al-Adel as well as the son of Osama bin Laden and what's going on in Iran right now. But first, we have to break for 60 seconds. Stay with us. You're listening to Democracy Now. Just 1 minute. We're just going to break for 60 seconds and come back to you. Just 1 sec, De La Pirro. De La Pirro with us from Britain, who's written many books, including Neighbors, Not Friends, Iraq and Iran After the Gulf Wars. Be back with him in a minute. Shagbir Prelude here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman as we continue our discussion with De La Pirro, author of 24 books, including Neighbors, Not Friends, Iraq and Iran After the Gulf War. So these two men I wanted to ask you about, one being Saif al-Adel in The Observer. It says he is the most senior al-Qaeda operative still at large after Osama bin Laden and his closest associate, Ayman al-Zawahiri. The U.S. intelligence operatives claim he is operating out of Iran, and Osama bin Laden's son, Saad bin Laden. U.S. officials believe that he is somewhere in Iran. Your comments.
Yeah, I think certainly, I think it's very simple. I mean, if the U.S. intelligence has this information, why don't they pass this on to the Iranian government and say, we have this information, you know, you have to be a little bit more specific. Remember the information that the U.S. and the U.K. had about their weapons of mass destruction, which they passed on to Mr. Blix and also Dr. Baradai of the IAEA? What happened? Those guys checked out these things. You know, there were 11 instances where Bush and Blair said, ah, there are WMDs, there are WMDs. Of course, these guys sent the inspectors. They found nothing. So, see, I'm sorry. I keep, you know, going back to what happened to, because, you know, when we study history back or the past or history, which is a part of my job, then you understand what's happening exactly now. So to my point is simple. Haven't we been here before? The U.S. intelligence says so and so. All right. If you have this information, pass it on. Be specific. You know, this is what Dr. Blix said. Information that we were given was not actionable. We could not act on it. Okay, so now they are saying this, his son is there. So please, this one. Secondly, let me just give you a personal thing. I was there in Tehran in July of last year. I had a very long session with the Indian ambassador. You know, he's ambassador of that level. You know, and he said to me, I'm talking of July 2002, that is, you know, after the Taliban, after the 9/11, et cetera, and he said, yes, the Iranian government has arrested al-Qaeda, about 250 of them, and of course all these al-Qaeda people arrested have different nationalities, and according to the Indian ambassador, as soon as they arrest people, they inform those embassies that we have your nationals, you know, who are al-Qaeda, they are in our jail, they are in our prison. Now, sometimes that government, like maybe, you know, maybe Egypt or Jordan, they don't want to get these guys back home because there will be more trouble if they have them at home. Rather, much better they are, you know, rotting in the Iranian jail. But in the case of Saudi Arabia, they said, yes, we want these guys in our country to try them. And sure, the Iranians put those Saudi nationals who were Al-Qaeda members on a plane, sent them off to Riyadh, and the Saudi foreign minister, whom you quoted earlier, you know, in your introduction, publicly said, we have received Al-Qaeda members from Iran. So since then, the figures are about 500 Al-Qaeda members have been arrested, and they are either in Iranian jails or they have been sent to their countries if those countries are prepared to take them. The question is not about Iran itself. You only have to look at the map, geography. And I wish, you know, people like Rumsfeld would really every so often look at the map. The map is, where is Afghanistan? It's surrounded by these countries. You have countries to Central Asia. None of those countries are so gung-ho anti-fundamentalism. None of these guys will run there. They can either go to Pakistan, which is cooperating with the USA very actively, or if they have to go overland, they can only go into Iran. It's a physical thing. And the border between Pakistan and Iran, see, Iran has border with Afghanistan and also with Pakistan. The border, common border with Pakistan is very, very rugged. It's very difficult to patrol. And a lot of drug trafficking goes on from there, et cetera, for the past many, many years. So the Iranians, you know, whatever they can actually do, they actually capture them. Finally, I only wish that some of these people really read up some material. You know, that book by Ahmad Rashid, Taliban. It clearly shows that Iran has always been against Taliban. Iran has always been against Taliban. Remember, in September 98, Iran was about to have a war with the Taliban regime. And who said to them, hold off, don't get worked up? President Clinton. President Clinton said to advise Iran to back generals not to attack Taliban in September 98. Now, remember that Taliban are Sunni Muslims. They are not only Sunni, but they are very hard-line Sunni Muslims. And according to them, Shia Muslims are somehow not 100% Muslim. They are 90% Muslim, maybe 95%, but they are not fully-fledged Muslims. They have a great low esteem for Shia Muslims. In Afghanistan, under Taliban, Shia Muslims were not allowed to have their ceremonies of Ashura, when you beat your breast for the loss of Imam Hussein, which you probably saw in Karbala. You saw this in the huge 1.5 million Shiites went to Karbala. That kind of a thing was not allowed by the Taliban regime in Afghanistan, because Afghanistan has 25% of Muslims who are Shiite, and they were persecuted or they were put down. Now, how do you expect, using a little bit of knowledge, a little bit of history, a little bit of culture, how do you expect the regime of Iran, which is 87% Shiite, to be having alliance or a link with Taliban and Al-Qaeda, who do not have a single Shiite member? If somebody can point out, after 17,000 members, they now have one single Shiite Muslim, I think, you know, if somebody is brave enough to do that, I'm sure that, you know, they will deserve 10 free copies of my book. So what I'm saying is that all of this thing that is being said, so-and-so is there, fine. Be specific, pass on information to the government, look at the Iranian government, what it has done. 500 people arrested, they have put them in jail, or they have sent them to their home countries if they are prepared to take them. They have always, always, always been against Taliban long before Bush And Clinton realized what Taliban were about, you know, and historical reasons for it.
De Lapiro, let me switch gears a little bit, ask you about peace in the Financial Times today. The reporting that the editor of a liberal Saudi newspaper was removed from his post yesterday amid a strong backlash from the religious establishment against a publication that has dared to criticize Saudi Arabia's puritanical Wahhabi Islam as contributing to extremism. The sacking of Jamal Khashoggi, editor of Al-Watan, was seen as a victory for Saudi conservatives and a sign of the limits that will be imposed on a nascent debate over the role of religion in the wake of the May 12th suicide attacks against Western residential compounds. Your comment on Khashoggi's sacking.
No, sir. Is this something happening in Saudi Arabia
This in Saudi Arabia. It's switching gears to Saudi Arabia. It says, since the bombings, Al-Watan has turned into a forum for self-criticism, publishing opinion columns that touch on sensitive religious issues, including questioning historic religious figures such as Ibn Taymiyyah, a main source of Wahhabi thought.
Yeah, that's quite true. I think, again, you know, it's important to understand. I think here I have to very briefly quote Robert McNamara. You know, Robert McNamara was actually at the Cannes Film Festival because a documentary on him was shown, and he pointed out, and it's again worth remembering, you know, if I make historical references, not becoming giving a lesson, history lesson, but we have to understand parallels of situations so that we don't make the same mistake again. What did Robert McNamara say? He said, our major problem was in Vietnam, we did not understand their culture, we did not understand their history. The same problem right now. You know, the guys who are running this, you know, Middle East policy and the policy on terrorism, I don't think they have a clue about the differences amongst Muslims. They have no clue about the culture of Arabs, et cetera, et cetera. And very quickly, Wahhabis are a very extreme sect within Islam. You know, there are four schools in Islam, and they're Hanbali school. Within Hanbali school, the Wahhabis are very extreme, and Wahhabis are very much against the Shia Muslims. And to be very specific, that big march that I'm sure most of you must have seen, you know, about 6 weeks ago in Iraq, all these 1.5 million Shias, Shiites going on pilgrimage to Karbala, that particular shrine of Hussein, the Wahhabis believe that you, when you die on your grave, there should be no decoration at all. Not even, you know, a gravestone or something. It should be just a simple, you know, burial. That's it. Now, in Karbala and also in Najaf, you have these shrines to the imams of the Shiites, which are full of decoration and gold and silver and so on and so forth. And the Wahhabis, when they were on their rampage, went and destroyed the shrines of Hussein and Karbala. Of course, they are fellow Muslims, but they said, you know, you cannot have this. In Islam, you are not allowed to do this. So what I'm giving this example is that it is not that simple simply to say they are Muslim or because they're Saudis. You have to be very specific. Yes, if they are Wahhabi, Sunni Muslims, just like bin Laden, then they would be very extreme. They are extremely puritanical, and they do not allow, you know, singing, dancing, all kinds of things, you know. Whereas if you are Shia Islam, you know, a lot of it, in a way, it's much more relaxed and so on and so forth. And so the moral of that is to expect that these two streams, two strands within a general overarching state of Islam can somehow be together and conduct joint operations is unthinkable. You know, the Wahhabis hate Shiites and Shiites hate Wahhabis. It's a fact of life. And that has been going on for centuries, you know, and nothing to do with, you know, what's happening since 9/11 or before 9/11, which is a much more recent thing.
Well, De Lapiro, I want to thank you very much for being with us. De Lapiro is the author of many books, more than 24 books, including Iraq and the Eye of the Storm, as well as Neighbors, Not Friends, Iraq and Iran After the Gulf Wars. And you are listening to Democracy Now! In a few minutes, we're going to look at a report in the Financial Times about how the U.S. abandoned the U.N. in January, deciding on war well before they told the American people, at a time when they were telling the American people that war was a last resort. We'll be going to him, but first, we turn to a former Army Ranger who is in Panama, who has spent his last years doing something interesting, and that is putting together a book of war posters. Hermann Göring, at his Nuremberg trial in 1946, said, "Naturally, the common people don't want war. But after all, it's the leaders of the country who determine the policy, and it's always a simple matter to drag the people along, whether it's a democracy or a fascist dictatorship or a parliament or a communist dictatorship. Voice or no voice, the people can always be brought to the bidding of the leaders. That's easy. All you have to do is tell them they are being attacked and denounce the pacifists for lack of patriotism and exposing the country to danger. It works the same way in any country." This quote by Hermann Göring is published on the first page of Micah Wright's new book of remixed war posters called "You Back the Attack, We'll Bomb Who We Want." It's published by Seven Stories Press. After spending 4 years invading other countries as an airborne ranger in the U.S. Army, Micah Wright moved on to the next logical step in his career, writing children's animation. Upon earning a degree in political science and creative writing from the University of Arizona, Micah relocated to Los Angeles and began writing at Nickelodeon Animation, where he wrote for Nicktoons, The Angry Beavers, which was nominated for an Emmy and an Annie Award. He's also the creator of the first true American anime show, Constant Pain, and is co-creator of the acclaimed Chet Thunderhead Private Eye animated series. So why, Micah Wright, did you do this book of remixed war posters? And what do you mean by remixed?
Well, what do I mean by remix? They're actually old World War II posters that I've repainted and taken out the old text and put in new text. For an image that used to say something along the lines of, you know, "Have you really tried to save gas by joining a car club?" I've changed the image. I've changed the words to, "The more gas your SUV uses, the more foreigners I have to kill." The image is of a U.S. Army soldier, you know, bleeding from his forehead wound, which I think is kind of shocking. You would never see that in any sort of like Pentagon press briefing today. You know, the bloody soldiers, they try to hide all of those details from us these days.
And then you have on the back of your book a poster of a U.S. soldier in full combat gear with helmet, and he is throwing a grenade. And the quote is, "What the expletive am I doing here? I only joined up for the college money."
Yeah, that's actually my favorite poster I think I've ever done, because that's literally me. That guy right there, that's me. I joined the Army to pay for college, and it did pay for college. And you know, at the end of the day, it was a very Faustian bargain that I did not feel comfortable with at the end of it.
When did you join?
1987.
And when did you go to college?
1991, so 4 years.
And during that time, what did you do?
I was an airborne ranger. I lived a life of danger. That's a Jody call, sorry. You know, things we sing when we march around. The Rangers are the first to fight in the United States Army. We invaded Panama. We took out their primary Air Force base, just demolished it, and then spread throughout the country looking for Noriega, looking for his personal bodyguards. You know, it seems like all these dictators always have their special military units, and we spread throughout the country looking for them. And then we, you know, kind of wound up back in Panama City just in time to watch it burn to the ground. So,
what effect did that have on you? What happened and in the city?
Well, you know, when you're jumping out of a plane and there's people shooting at you when you're in a parachute and you get to the ground, you don't feel real bad about shooting back at them. But, you know, when you're standing on a street corner and you're watching 80,000 people flee a fire and they're dragging their two kids and their television set behind them, it kind of brings it home that, you know, what the United States does overseas is not exactly all fun and games, and it's not always aimed at the people who are responsible. I mean, you know, there was a slum in Panama called El Chorrillo, and we bombed their version of the Pentagon, a place called the Comandancia, and the fire spread from the Comandancia into a slum. It was just a built-up, huge slum with no fire safety and no, you know, modern building standards, and it just fire raged for 3 days and burned to the ground and left 80,000 people homeless and killed countless numbers of people in the fire itself. And, you know, and just created this, you know, immense refugee crisis that we were completely ill-prepared to deal with because, you know, again, we're trained to kill, not to take care of people. And you see the same thing happening now in Iraq. You know, you have a military structure which ignored every possible warning that they had that they would be facing a massive civilian catastrophe, and they didn't put any extra military police units in. They didn't have anywhere near enough boots on the ground to make sure that they didn't have the rioting. And they willfully refused to learn from the past invasions and from the past lessons of their wars.
In Panama, where were you when Chorrillo was burning down?
Well, when the fire started, I was actually still at Rio Hato, and then when it was winding down, I was in Panama City.
And what were other soldiers saying, other Rangers? Were you alone in your feelings?
No, I don't think I was. I think I've always been a lot more outspoken about the way I feel about things, but I know a lot of people were just sitting there watching that and just, you know, shaking their heads and just going, you know, what's the point of this? You know, this is a war on civilians. And whether or not it was an accident, which many people say it was or not, it doesn't matter. I mean, it's still the end of the day. There's tons of people dead, and there's, you know, thousands, you know, tens of thousands of people out of the house.
We have to break for 60 seconds. When we come back, I want to ask you about some of the posters that you've done and also about the effect of media consolidation on your work.
Oh, yeah, sure.
So, folks, stay with us. We're talking to Micah Ian Wright. His book is You Back the Attack, We'll Bomb Who We Want, Remixed War Propaganda by Micah Wright. Stay with us.
Oh, I'd go anywhere to fight for oil, be it olives, safflower, crude. For cooking, for cars, take a rocket to the stars for a back rub, romantic rendezvous. In your engine, on your face, or almost any place, a little dab of oil will get you through. Oh, I'd go anywhere to fight for oil, to lubricate the red, white, and blue. If you drive a big V8, it's time to celebrate. They're gonna fight a war for you. To keep gas prices cheap, so when you drive or when you sleep, you can do it in an air-conditioned room. For driving is your right, so let's get out there and fight. You can read that in the Constitution. Shouldn't I go anywhere to fight for oil, to lubricate the red, white, and blue? Here we go now. I'd go anywhere to fight for oil, be it olive, safflower, crude. For cooking, for cars, take a rocket to the stars for a backward romantic rendezvous. In your engine, on your face, or almost any place, a little dab of oil will get you through.
I'd go anywhere to fight for oil, to lubricate the red, white, and blue. Dana Lyons here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. Our guest is Micah Wright, who was an Army Ranger, fought in Panama, and went to college as a result of his enlisting, and now has second thoughts. The picture on the back of his book, as if you're just joining us, he said, is the one that best depicts him. What the am I doing here? A man, a soldier throwing a grenade. I only joined up for the college money. What about the quote that you have of Hermann Göring?
Oh, yeah, I know. I mean, it's kind of horrifying that you're actually quoting a Nazi, and yet what he says is so, it's so amazingly true. You saw that the Nazis did it themselves, you know, the Reichstag fire, whether it was started by a communist and whether it was started by the Nazi party, it's yet still not to be cleared up from what I understand. And yet they used that to push through a whole series of laws, giving themselves essentially unchallenged power over every aspect of German culture. And you see the same thing today with Patriot Act and Patriot Act 2. And it's happening in this country. And everyone, it's so easy to say. Everyone always says, oh, you know, Bush is a Nazi or whatever. And I don't think he's a Nazi. I just think he's a fascist.
I'm looking at page 50 of your book. Maybe you can describe your poster.
Oh, yeah. It's, in this one, actually, I didn't actually have to change many of the words. It says, it can happen here. And there's a photo of a house, and it's all burned to the ground and bombed out. And there's, you know, 1942 sedan, and it's all smashed and toppled, and the brick chimney is collapsed, and it says, someone could do to us what we did to Afghanistan, unless we kill them all first. And the original text said something like, it can happen here, so make sure you make a lot of guns and bombs for the, you know, for the soldiers, or something like that. But, yeah, I mean, just the idea that it can happen here, it did happen here, I mean, 9/11 did happen here, but, you know, Iraq had nothing whatsoever to do with that, and people seem to have completely bought into this whole, you know, Fox News, Bush administration spin that Iraq was responsible for 9/11. And again, that's, you know, going back to the theme of propaganda, that's just modern propaganda. You know, Bush mentions 9/11 and Saddam Hussein, 9/11 in Iraq, in the same sentence any number of times. He never says Saddam did 9/11. But, you know what, 72% of the American public now believe that Saddam was responsible for 9/11? That's an astounding number. It's a disgusting number. And yet, the spin has worked, the modern propaganda. I mean, you know, it's advanced a little bit since the 1940s. It's no longer posters. Now it's moving posters, you know, Fox News.
Page 40, picture of a man and his daughter and son are sitting next to him. He's reading to them. And you have the daughter saying to the father, Daddy, why don't you or any of your friends from Enron have to go to war?
Yeah, that's a very famous recruiting poster. It's one of the most effective recruiting posters of World War One. It was a British poster. It was painted by an artist named Savile Lumley. And it was the original text was, Daddy, what did you do in the Great War? And, you know, and he's, like, very uncomfortably, like, kind of pulling at his collar, like, And so the impression there is, you know, your children are going to ask why you were such a coward when it came to wartime.
What about media consolidation? You're a cartoonist, too, or animator. We're talking to Micah Wright. We are seeing on June 2nd, the FCC is expected to rule, led by Michael Powell, son of Colin Powell, on relaxation of media rules, which will allow the further consolidation of the media. How does that affect you?
Well, in a number of ways, it's already affected me. The 1996 Telecommunications Deregulation Act began a huge wave of mergers that collapsed the number of producers of television and film into, you know, what they say, there's like 8 companies now, pretty much run every channel on cable television. And that's expected to reduce even further after this next wave of deregulation on June 2nd. And we went from, you know, several, you know, tens of, you know, almost 20 producers of animated programming to now there's only about 4. You have AOL Time Warner, who owns Cartoon Channel, Boomerang, Kids WB. And then you have, you know, Disney, who owns Disney and ABC. And you have Universal, Vivendi. And you have, and that's pretty much about it right now. There's not many. Oh, I'm sorry, Viacom, of course, my old employers, who own MTV, MTV Animation, TNN, and soon to be renamed Spike TV for some reason, and Nickelodeon. And when I was working at Nickelodeon, actually, the WGA, the Writers Guild of America, the union that covers writers, came to us and they said, well, are you guys covered? And we said, well, no, we don't have a union. We don't have any union coverage. And they said, well, if you look at what your live action contemporaries make, they make, you know, hundreds of thousands more for the same amount of work that you're doing. And your work actually is more profitable for the corporations. And so we thought about it, and almost to a person, we all signed a union card, and then Nickelodeon fired us all, which is, you know, illegal. They claimed it was layoffs. They claimed it was, you know, oh, we just happened to be ending this show all of a sudden, you know, 3 weeks after you all signed your union card. But, yeah, the WGA appealed to the National Labor Relations Board, and it basically went nowhere. because you know you have a Bush appointee at the head of the National Labor Relations Board, and there are a lot of very questionable things that happened. You know, the NLRB came out and interrogated people with a representative of the company there. I mean, which is again, you know, totally against federal law. I mean, there was just like all these things that just happened, and as a result, not only did we never got our election. You know, you sign your union card. You're supposed to have an election, and if you win the election, then you're a union house. We never got an election, and in addition, like I think 19 writers were laid off out of a total of like 25, and the ones who didn't get laid off, you know, just coincidentally were the ones who didn't sign union cards, and like five of us were blacklisted. We can't, you know, like I can't get a job writing an animation right now. It's just, it's not happening. I had the composer for one of my shows was at Universal, and he was having a meeting with an executive, and she said, "Oh, did you do the music for this Constant Pain show?" And he said, yeah, it's, you know, it's really great. It's this sort of jazzy thing. And she said, "Oh, you want to take that off your resume?" And he was like, "What do you mean?" And she said, "Well, yeah, this guy, the word's out on him. No one's going to hire him ever again. And you don't want to be sullied by being associated with him."
Well,
and it's easy to do because it's only three calls now, you know? You call Universal, you call AOL Time Warner, and you call Viacom, and, you know, you've pretty much blacklisted somebody out of the animation industry.
Well, you're not blacklisted in... at least independent bookstores.
Yeah, no. And what's, you know, what's funny is I'm actually writing a comic book, a monthly comic book for AOL Time Warner. So
we are talking to Micah Ian Wright, and I want to thank you very much for being with us.
You
Back the Attack, We'll Bomb Who We Want, Remixed War Propaganda, with a foreword by Kurt Vonnegut, an introduction by Howard Zinn, commentary by the Center for Constitutional Rights, and it is published by an independent by Seven Stories Press. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
As we wrap up today's show with Financial Times investigation. In the build-up to the U.S. invasion of Iraq, White House officials told the American people up until March that the president had not decided to use military force and would only consider it as a last resort. Well, a new report in the Financial Times reveals France had concluded in early January that the U.S. had abandoned the diplomatic path and was already determined to overthrow Saddam Hussein using military force. The conclusion confirmed to the Financial Times by the French foreign minister, Dominique de Villepin, lay at the heart of the confrontation between U.S. and Britain and the anti-war camp of France, Germany, and Russia. Bush administration officials indicated that the French assessment was justified. We turn right now to the author of the piece, James Harding, who is stationed in Washington, D.C. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Hi.
Well, can you talk further about the sources that you had that talked about when the U.S. decided to invade Iraq?
Well, I think, as you said, I mean, what we've written is that the French calculation was in the middle of January that the U.S. was certainly going to war and that the diplomatic option had no real chance. And that seems as though that was well-founded. You speak to people... in the White House, and they say there was an internal moment for Mr. Bush. The president had a briefing with the likes of Condi Rice, his national security advisor, and others, Bob Joseph, also on the National Security Council, and Colin Powell, after the declaration of the weapons declaration presented by Saddam Hussein was reviewed by them. And their view was that Mr. Hussein had taken a strategic decision, in their words, that he was not going to cooperate. And I guess if you look back over the last couple of years, the view would be that there was a willingness to, quote-unquote, do Iraq by this administration from the moment they arrived in office. Over the summer, after September the 11th, obviously that willingness hardened into a determination. Over the summer of 2002, there was a decision to press ahead. It was always most likely to be resolved in a military fashion, but they were leaving open a diplomatic solution. And I guess what we're finding is that by December, so well in advance of the presentations by Blix and well in advance of the long UN process, there was pretty much a determination that this was going to have to be military force. And it explains also the increasing troop deployments in the Gulf at that time.
And what was the understanding of Russia and Germany?
Well, I think, I mean, obviously you have to take each one separately. The president has had a good relationship with Vladimir Putin. They had a good discussion when Mr. Bush and Mr. Putin saw each other in St. Petersburg towards the end of last year. Obviously, Mr. Putin had a bunch of different interests and a bunch of different pressures when it came to Iraq, although the view from the White House is those were always communicated pretty clearly. When it comes to Germany, Mr. Bush has had a famously bad relationship with Mr. Schroeder. The view was that in a private conversation between the president and the chancellor of Germany, Schroeder gave a sense to the U.S. president that he would support, or he would not stand in the way of the U.S. as it pursued its agenda on Iraq. And Mr. Bush felt as though Mr. Schroeder had not kept his word. And that has led to a real souring of relations right at the top. In some ways, the irony is that actually diplomatic relations between Germany and the U.S. have been good on the official level, on the working level. But right at the top, they're lousy.
We're talking to James Harding, who's a reporter for the Financial Times stationed in Washington, D.C. Big piece, War in Iraq, How the Die Was Cast Before Transatlantic Diplomacy Failed. So, I mean, now people look back and say, oh, whatever, the U.S., you know, planned to do this, yes. But at the time, it's very significant, the timing. When you talk about back in December, the U.S. deciding, making a decision after Iraq put in its declaration. And then certainly it was February, wasn't it, when Colin Powell went to the United Nations Security Council to make his case for war? But you're saying, you know, more than a month before that, the die had been cast.
Yeah, and I suppose if you look at it also, that's to look at it from the Iraq point of view. If you look at it from the European point of view, there was also another really fundamental casualty of the whole Iraq crisis, which was the sense of unity and solidarity within Europe. Just after the period at which the French decided that the U.S. was going to go to war, division started to emerge within Europe, and they're very important right now. The president's just headed off to Poland later this week and on to Russia and then to France for the G8 summit. And the relentless question will be, what does the transatlantic relationship now mean to the Bush administration? Clearly, it is a different relationship. It has different significance from the one that they thought it had, I was going to say 2 years ago, even 6 months ago. There is a sense that the transatlantic relationship should be used for good, but at certain times the U.S. is going to seek to act over the heads of its transatlantic allies.
And you talk about MGM, French President Jacques Chirac's personal diplomatic advisor, Maurice Gordeau-Montaigne.
Yes. Well, I suppose there were a few key moments from the French point of view when they really determined that the U.S. was going to take military action to get rid of Saddam Hussein. And I should say that this says something not only about U.S. determination, but to a certain extent about French naivety. How the French could not have seen what Dick Cheney's speech in August last year was saying. I mean, he was very clear that inaction is not an option. How the French could have misread what Mr. Bush was trying to do when he went to the UN on September the 12th and said, we're going to do Iraq anyway, it is a big question. I mean, to a certain extent, I think the French, if their accounts are true, and if this is not them trying to rewrite history and explain how they suddenly woke up in the middle of January and started agitating against military action, if their accounts are true, then it shows a real naivety on their part. But the key moment in terms of, I think, Chirac, if there was an internal moment for Bush, which was seeing this declaration and getting briefed on this declaration, then there was an internal moment for Chirac, which was he sent his chief policy advisor, the equivalent of Condi Rice.
We have 5 seconds.
To the White House. They had lunch. It was clear there was going to be war.
Well, I want to thank you very much, James Harding, for being with us at the Financial Times, and that does it for the show. If you want to get a copy, you can call 1-800-881-2359, 1-800-881-2359. Democracy Now! Produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Andrew Karen, Sharif Abdul-Qaduce, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, with help from Noah Rybel, Mike DeFilippo, our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman. From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Governments are artificial creations. Governments are set up by the people to ensure certain rights, equality, life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness. When governments become destructive of those ends, I'm now quoting the Declaration of Independence, when governments become, if it doesn't mind, when governments become destructive of those ends, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish the government. You see.
Today, a conversation between acclaimed people's historian Howard Zinn and the Booker Prize-winning author Arundhati Roy.
I'm actually not a nationalist of any kind. You know, I believe that we... I think it's very important to stop our minds coming up short against these artificial boundaries. And I think nationalism really does lie at the root of a lot of the troubles of this century and the last one. And we really need to question that.
Arundhati Roy and Howard Zinn, but first, over 100 cities have passed resolutions condemning the USA Patriot Act, but a small city in California has gone a step further. They've made it illegal for their local authorities to comply. And the Supreme Court has refused to hear an appeal on the hundreds of secret deportation hearings of foreigners detained after September 11th.
Secrecy has absolutely no place when it comes to depriving individuals of their most fundamental right to liberty.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld yesterday suggested publicly for the first time that Iraq may have destroyed its weapons of mass destruction before the U.S. invaded. Rumsfeld has repeatedly said it's just a matter of time before the weapons of mass destruction will be found in Iraq. The BBC reports this is the closest the Bush administration has ever come to admitting they may never find such weapons in Iraq. Meanwhile, the Guardian of London reports the good news for the Pentagon is that its investigators have finally unearthed evidence of weapons of mass destruction, including 100 vials of anthrax and other dangerous bacteria. The bad news? The stash was found not in Iraq, but fewer than 50 miles from Washington, near Fort Detrick, Maryland. The anthrax is a non-virulent strain, and the discoveries are apparently remnants of an abandoned germ warfare program. Interestingly, there is no documentation about the biological agents disposed of at the U.S. Biodefense Center at Fort Detrick. In the run-up to the invasion of Iraq, U.S. officials said Iraq's failure to come up with paperwork proving the destruction of its biological arsenal is evidence of deception. The London Guardian is reporting in the months before the U.S. invasion of Iraq, the Pentagon ignored repeated warnings that it would need a substantial military police force immediately after the invasion to provide law and order. This, according to U.S. government advisors, some 4,000 U.S. military police are now being deployed to Baghdad, but only after most Iraqi government services have been crippled by a wave of looting and arson. According to The Guardian, the anarchy in the streets was predicted by several panels of former ambassadors, soldiers, and peacekeeping experts who advised the Pentagon and the White House while the invasion was being planned. They urged that lessons be learned from previous U.S.-led military interventions and a post-conflict police force be established before the war. Most U.S. military police are reservists who are given just one day's instruction in dealing with civilian crowds, and the U.S. Army Peacekeeping Institute is being closed in September. Saudi Arabian officials have arrested five men suspected of involvement in the suicide attacks on residential compounds in Riyadh. An unnamed source told Reuters that the officials believe one of the suspects was the mastermind behind the attacks. The source also said the arrests were made in the Muslim holy city of Medina. On May 12th, bombers hit three residential compounds known to house Westerners. 34 people were killed. Meanwhile, the editor of a liberal Saudi newspaper was sacked yesterday after his paper dared to criticize Saudi Arabia's puritanical Wahhabi sect of Islam as contributing to extremism. According to the Financial Times, the Al-Watan paper turned into a forum for self-criticism after the recent suicide bombings in Riyadh. Columnists slammed the education system as breeding extremists, disapproved of religious police, and questioned some of Wahhabi sect's most historic figures. The sacking is seen as a victory for the conservative religious establishment. The newspaper is majority owned by a Saudi prince. The fired editor was Jamal Khashoggi. The U.S. Supreme Court yesterday ruled 6-3 state workers can sue their employers for violating the Family and Medical Leave Act. The law entitles the workers to take up to 12 weeks of unpaid leave for work for several reasons, including birth, adoption, or a family emergency. The court extended the protections of the federal law to almost 5 million state employees. The ruling breaks with the court's recent tradition of siding with states against the federal government involving the extension of federal anti-discrimination laws. Women's rights groups have hailed the ruling. However, the Supreme Court yesterday refused to hear an appeal of a federal court decision that upheld Bush administration policy of holding secret deportation hearings for hundreds of foreign nationals detained after September 11th. We'll have more on that story in a minute. Also yesterday, the Supreme Court ruled a police sergeant did not violate the rights of a seriously injured farm worker by interrogating him at the hospital without reading him his Miranda rights. In 1997, Oxnard, California police shot Oliverio Martinez five times and then subjected him to a lengthy interrogation while he was awaiting medical treatment. According to a transcript of the interview, Martinez told the police officer, quote, "I am choking. I am dying. Please." The officer replied, "If you're going to die, tell me what happened." Martinez was left blind and paralyzed. Dissenting Justice John Paul Stevens compared the interrogation to, quote, "an attempt to obtain an involuntary confession from a prisoner by torturous methods." The Miranda warnings begin with, you have the right to remain silent. This ruling means police officers cannot be sued for failing to read someone these rights. Martinez may still be allowed to collect damages on the grounds that his constitutional due process rights were violated. The Archbishop of Canterbury and other Anglican church leaders said yesterday they cannot support ceremonies blessing gay partnerships. Issuing a statement from a meeting in Brazil, the church leaders said the issue is divisive and there is no theological consensus on the issue. The controversy intensified recently when a bishop in Vancouver approved blessing rituals for gay men and lesbians. And more than 100 non-governmental organizations from around the world have issued an Evian water challenge to leaders of the group of eight major industrial nations that will meet next week in Evian, France. The challenge demands that the G8 nations stop pressuring developing countries to privatize their water resources. The European Union has been especially aggressive in this effort. The EU is demanding 72 countries open their water sectors to foreign private investment in the world trade negotiations. This would greatly benefit the six major multinational corporations, which account for virtually all private investment in water utilities in developing countries. They include the Francis Suez and Vivendi Environment Corporations, as well as Bechtel. Bechtel is the U.S. corporation that won the first major reconstruction contract in Iraq.
Do you want a society? humanity, where the people are only one color? Do you want a society full of oppression and racism? Do you want the children to live in hunger in the streets? Do you want the people deprived of their liberty? Mba, 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 hey. Mba, 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 hey.
I am so angry, so afraid. I cannot express the fear I have inside.
Today we chose 100 backward steps. Today we chose freedom and integrity. Today we chose hate for equality. Today we took 100 backward steps. Today we chose freedom and integrity. Today we chose hate for equality. We took 100 backward steps. Today we took 100 backward steps. 59% of us chose to turn teachers into spies. 59% of us chose to refuse pregnant mothers' care. 59% of us chose to reserve health care for the wealthy.
Mba, 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 hey. Mba, 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 hey.
I am so angry, so full of rage. I cannot express the fear I have inside. I am so angry, so full of rage. I cannot express the fear I have inside. 59% of us chose to push immigrants.
Copper Women. No 187 here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. More than 100 cities and one state have adopted resolutions condemning the USA Patriot Act. But last month, Arcata, California, took it a step further. The Arcata City Council adopted a city ordinance that makes cooperation with the Patriot Act a crime. Starting this month, any city department head who voluntarily complies with investigations or arrests under the Patriot Act will be fined $57. The USA Patriot Act gives the government new powers to snoop on citizens, including using wiretaps and electronic surveillance and gathering information from public libraries. Opponents say it violates civil liberties. Supporters say it helps fight terrorism. We're joined now by David Meserve of the Arcata City Council, who authored the ordinance. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much, Amy.
It's good to have you with us. So tell us about, well, this very unusual legislation. A lot of legislation around the country against the USA Patriot Act, but yours has teeth.
Well, back in January, we were among the, at that time, about 30 cities that had passed resolutions against the Patriot Act. And we figured we just would take it a step further and actually pass an ordinance that made compliance with the Patriot Act illegal, with unconstitutional portions of the Patriot Act. And basically what it does is remove city officials from the chain of command in the enforcement of unconstitutional provisions of the Act. So we're just saying that our city officials will not cooperate with any unconstitutional provisions.
And what has been the response of the government?
There has been no real response, we like to say, and we haven't really been requested to do anything by the federal government. We like to say that this is a preemptive attack in defense of the Constitution, to borrow some words from our resident. But we do feel that the Justice Department has said that it is that federal law trumps local law, and that therefore this law doesn't really mean anything. We like to think that it really does. We go back to these Alien and Sedition Acts of 1798, and at that time it was another time of French bashing, and the federal government under Adams was trying to declare war against France, and they made it illegal to criticize the government, and they made things much harder on anyone trying to get citizenship. And at that time, both Madison and Jefferson in Virginia and Kentucky, respectively, passed resolutions in which they said that the duty of the federal government under the Constitution is that the Constitution is a compact to secure our rights. And when the federal government breaks that compact by limiting our rights or limiting our liberties, then it's the responsibility of the states or, by extension, municipalities to stand up and say, no, we won't comply with these laws.
Arcata is a city of, what, 16,300 miles north of San Francisco, one of the, what was the first city with a Green Party majority, Greens holding 2 of 5 seats on the council. Would that explain how this got passed?
You know, to some extent it does, but the thing about the opposition to the Patriot Act, I think, is that although progressives have always been firmly against the Progressive Act and favoring civil liberties, this happens to be an issue that really bridges the left and right spectrum of the political spectrum, because people on the right and people in the middle all want to defend the Constitution. Now, those on the far right love the Bill of Rights. They may have their favorite amendment, maybe the second, but they still love the Bill of Rights, and people all across the political spectrum want to defend our civil liberties. So this is, I think, what's exciting about this movement and the fact that there's over 100 cities that have passed resolutions is that it really bridges the traditional political boundaries. We have an opportunity here, as you know, mainly your listeners are probably towards the left, but we have an opportunity here to work with people all across the spectrum and to actually cause a little dis-ease in Washington, I would hope.
Well, I want to thank you very much, David Mazur, for joining us from Arcata, California. Again, just passed legislation through the city council that would fine law enforcement or anyone that tried to enforce the USA Patriot Act. And there is a resolution going through the New York City Council today that would also speak out against the USA Patriot Act. The Supreme Court has handed a victory to the Bush administration yesterday, refusing to hear a challenge to close secret deportation hearings held for hundreds of foreigners detained after the September 11th attacks. Following the attacks, the government ordered all immigration hearings closed if the detainees were deemed so-called special interest cases because of possible links to terrorism. Only the government can decide if a case is a special interest case. The appeal was brought by a group of New Jersey newspapers seeking information about the detainees. We asked the Justice Department for comment, but the media office declined to join us today. But we are joined by Lee Gallant, who is the head immigration attorney for the American Civil Liberties Union in New Jersey, lead counsel for the North Jersey Media Group. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Explain the court's decision.
The court decided not to review this case, but it did so in a very specific context. It did so in the context of the government explicitly telling the court that it was currently not conducting any more secret hearings pursuant to this policy, and that a revision process was underway and that it was likely to change the policy. I think that context is critical to understand the court's decision not to review this case. So I think I would dispute somewhat the characterization as a full victory for the Bush administration, because in effect the Bush administration ran away from the policy. We brought two cases, one in Detroit and one in New Jersey. We won one, the government won one. The government lost in the Sixth Circuit in the Court of Appeals in Cincinnati. It could have gone to the Supreme Court to ask the Supreme Court to review that case, and the Bush administration could have gone to the Supreme Court to defend its policies. It chose not to. In effect, it ran away from its policies, telling the Supreme Court, look, we're likely to change this policy. We're currently not conducting any more secret hearings. So I think that context is critical to understand what the court did yesterday.
Lee Gallant is head immigration attorney for the American Civil Liberties.
I'm actually a senior staff counsel at the National Office of the ACLU.
We'll be back in 60 seconds.
Would you harbor me? Would I harbor you? Would you harbor me? Would I harbor you? Would you harbor a Christian, a Muslim, a Jew? a heretic convict or spy? Would you harbor a runaway woman or child, a poet, a prophet, a king? Would you harbor an exile or a refugee, a person living with AIDS? Would you harbor a Tubman, a Garrett, a Truth, a fugitive, or a slave? Would you harbor a Haitian, Glorian, or Czech?
Would you harbor me, Sweet Honey in the Rock? And we'll be bringing you a Sweet Honey in the Rock special on Democracy Now! In the coming days. This is Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue our discussion about the ruling yesterday by the U.S. Supreme Court handing the Bush administration a victory when it refused to hear a challenge to close secret deportation hearings held for hundreds of immigrants detained after the September 11th attacks. Our guests, Lee Gallant, on the line with us, lead counsel for the North Jersey Media Group. And in the studio, we're joined by Nancy Chang, who's senior litigation attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights and author of Silencing Political Dissent. Nancy Chang, can you continue where Lee Gallant left off?
I very much agree with Lee that this decision has to be looked at in context, and I don't view it as a victory for the Bush administration, but I think it's worth noting that the Supreme Court has a long tradition of avoiding difficult issues of executive power during times of war. This happened during the Civil War when Lincoln suspended the writ of habeas corpus. It was not until after the war was over that the Supreme Court ruled that unconstitutional. And again, the Korematsu decision was not decided until long after the internment of the Japanese during World War II had ended. And even in that decision, it did not rule the detentions unconstitutional. And already, the Supreme Court this term has refused to consider two cases challenging anti-terrorism provisions that arose in the wake of September 11th, one involving Guantanamo detainees and one involving the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court.
Those the FISA court?
The FISA court.
And what was that one about?
In November of last year, a court of review for the Foreign Intelligence System decided that the Patriot Act could be broadly construed to allow the loose standards for foreign intelligence surveillance to be applied in cases where criminal investigation was taking place.
Lee Gallant, you represent the North Jersey Media Group. Can you explain further why the media brought this?
Well, I think the media brought it because they want to tell their readers what's going on. The public has a vital interest in knowing how these deportation proceedings are being conducted. That is true generally with respect to deportation proceedings. It is particularly true in the wake of September 11th, where the government itself has linked the deportation process and the anti-terrorism enforcement. The papers, as the Supreme Court said, act as a surrogate for the public. The public itself cannot attend every deportation proceeding or every criminal proceeding or every civil proceeding, but the newspapers can act as their surrogate to be there to inform them of what's going on. And it is critical that there be public scrutiny of the process for at least two reasons. One is that it ensures the integrity of the process. It's particularly important in deportation proceedings where often the detainee will have no counsel there, will literally be sitting in the courtroom all by themselves, maybe not speak English, have to go through an interpreter, have his very liberty at stake, facing a separation from his family, possibly being removed from the country where he has lived for 10, 20, 30 years, being separated from his wife and children, and he's fighting for all that, and he's literally in the courtroom by himself. In addition, very rarely do the federal courts overturn a deportation decision. So the only meaningful institutional check on the deportation process is the public is there to see what's going on, to keep people in line. The other thing that's critical is the appearance of justice, and that's irrespective of how fair the process actually is. What the Supreme Court has repeatedly said is that people can accept what they can see, but they will not accept what they cannot see. Now, the deportation process
involves enormous hardships to the immigrant community. But the immigrant community has largely accepted the deportation process. But if they can no longer see what's going on, if communities, wives, children, husbands are barred from going in the courtroom, and the government simply walks out of the courtroom and announces, your husband, your wife is now going to be detained for 12, 15 months and then deported, and they could not see what was going on, they could not see whether the process is fair, I think the faith the immigrant community has in the deportation process will quickly erode. And I think that's what's at stake here.
Nancy Chang, can you talk about which arm of government this represents and why that is significant?
Well, you raise a very interesting point, Amy. The CREPI directive that's under challenge in this case is purely a creation of the executive branch. It is not authorized by Congress. It is not part of the USA Patriot Act. And some of the most egregious violations of our civil liberties since September 11th have taken place through sheer executive fiat, not with congressional approval. And the immigration system includes not only this directive on closed hearings, but also an attorney general rule that was issued within days of September 11th that extended the time during which the immigrants could be detained without any charge, without any immigration or criminal charge. This is directly contrary to our constitutional norms. In addition, the Department of Defense has created a construct of enemy combatants and has claimed the right to hold individuals designated as enemy combatants, including U.S. citizens, indefinitely. And basically to lock them away in a dark hole without access to their lawyers or to anyone else who might assist them, with very little in the way of a showing that they are harmful to American interests.
Just before we wrap up, you're, Nancy, headed to a rally outside City Hall, following up on our first discussion in Arcata, California, about the USA Patriot Act, a resolution that's been introduced in the New York City Council.
That's right. It's a very exciting move. We are trying to restore civil liberties here in New York City. We are going to be joining, hopefully, over 100 municipalities around the country. And if we get New York City to sign on to this, we may have close to 20 million Americans living under jurisdictions where there are resolutions to restore civil liberties.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Nancy Chang is with the Center for Constitutional Rights. CCR represents the North Jersey Media Group. As well, I want to thank Lee Gallant for being with us, lead counsel for the North Jersey Media Group. The Supreme Court, again, just turned down said it would not hear a challenge to the closed secret deportation hearings held for hundreds of immigrants detained after September 11th. As we turn now to a report by one of our own producers who went out to two Jersey immigration centers. Noah Reibel is a student at the Columbia School of Journalism. Immigrant attorneys and advocates have compared the detention of Muslims post 9/11 to the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II. Now the government's investigating allegations of abuse in two immigration facilities, Passaic County Jail in Paterson, New Jersey, and the Metropolitan Detention Center in Brooklyn. Right now, we turn to Noah Reibel, who went out to the detention facilities.
The flag of the Corrections Corporation of America flies outside the INS Detention Center in Elizabeth, New Jersey. The flag is the only indication that this nondescript warehouse in an industrial no man's land in New Jersey is anything other than a storage facility. CCA is one of the largest security companies in the prison business. On a recent Saturday, a woman and her daughter waited outside the building to visit her brother.
They just sent him a letter saying he's eligible for a green card about almost a year now. Since he knew, they sent him a letter and he went to immigration. They kept him there. It's almost 6 months now. Nobody spoke to him. Nobody asked him why he isn't here.
She and her brother were born in Ethiopia, and she says he was picked up on a minor visa violation, and the government is threatening to deport him back to the country he left 14 years ago. Immigration attorneys and advocates are increasingly concerned about conditions in INS detention facilities.
The detention of immigrants in New Jersey has skyrocketed since 9/11.
Megan Kay is an immigration attorney with Catholic Community Services in Newark.
And now we're seeing an increased amount of detentions related to the special registration process. Most of those detainees are being held in county jails throughout New Jersey.
The INS not only contracts with private security companies like CCA, it also contracts detentions with dozens of prisons and jails, where INS detainees are held with the criminal populations.
Well, I mean, there's frequent problems with commingling of INS detainees and criminal detainees. The county jails are a much tougher place than the Elizabeth Detention Center.
And say a county prison in Paterson, New Jersey, is reputed to be one of the toughest. Last March, Amnesty International released a report that said INS detainees in Passaic were being subjected to physical and verbal abuse. In October, 75 detainees there signed a statement that said the jail wasn't fit for human habitation. 6 detainees went on a hunger strike in January. The Center for Constitutional Rights filed suit over the imprisonment and harsh treatment of immigrants last year. The suit claims that plaintiffs, Muslims from Pakistan and Turkey, were subjected to severe conditions during their detainment, including beatings, verbal abuse, solitary confinement, and the denial of right to religious practice. The government moved to have the case dismissed last year, and the CCR has opposed this motion, and a decision is pending.
From what I can tell, INS detainees, who are individuals in civil confinement, not criminal confinement, are being held in extremely punishing conditions.
Rachel Mirpol is a fellow at the center. She's been collecting testimony from detainees at Passaic for the past 5 months.
The men are squeezed into 2 dorms. It's extremely overcrowded. They're forced to sleep on 3-level bunk beds, so close to each other that they can't move without touching each other. The facility is filthy, and there's a serious roach infestation. They have no contact visitation whatsoever. They've been brutalized by guards. There's reports of systematic brutalization by the Passaic County guards, as well as some reports against INS officers visiting the facility.
The INS has steadfastly denied all allegations of abuse and substandard conditions at their contract facilities. After detainees released their statement in October, the INS said a recent random check at the facility found nothing wrong. But the complaints have not escaped the notice of the federal government, which last year launched an investigation into conditions in Passaic and the Metropolitan Detention Center. The Office of the Inspector General, which is conducting the investigation, was supposed to release a report last October. Rachel Mirpol is one of the attorneys eagerly awaiting their findings.
If the report truly exposes what I believe is going on at Passaic, then I think the public will be outraged, as they should be.
Despite repeated requests, no one from the INS or the Passaic County Sheriff's Department agreed to be interviewed for this report. DRUM, an immigrant rights organization in Queens, runs a toll-free hotline for INS detainees held in Passaic. With their consent, the organization recorded a few of the callers on March 13th, 2 months after the hunger strike was over.
I don't feel safe in this prison, and I'm in Passaic County Jail. Today, I was physically assaulted by police officers. Anybody say anything, they beat them up, kick them up. I was slammed into a gate by an officer. Captain Foster was there, observing everything. He didn't say nothing. For 6 months now, there's been a lot of physical altercation towards INS detainees by these officers. I feel that my life is really threatened in this jail, and I would like to get out of here. All I want is out of this jail.
Rachel Mirpol recognized one of the voices on the recordings.
What I can say is that I've met with him. I find his description of what's happened extremely credible. It's been backed up by quite a few of the other detainees. And my impressions of him is that, he's a very intelligent guy who's been caught up in something that is completely unjust.
During the war in Iraq, the Department of Homeland Security ordered political asylum seekers from 33 countries held until their status could be determined. The special registration program called for men from countries on the nation's terror watch list to voluntarily appear at INS centers to be photographed, fingerprinted, and in some cases interrogated. The program resulted in the arrest and detention of over 2,000 mostly Muslim foreigners. Kay has spent a good part of the last few months helping her clients comply with the confusing new regulations. And while the government said these policies were necessary to strengthen national security, she believes they're having the opposite effect.
The fear that this is creating is devastating to the communities, and I think in the end will hurt the safety of the United States, not in any way help it.
Why?
Because you're pushing thousands and thousands of people underground further. Instead of what we need to do, the whole theory of this registration is to bring to light who's in this country. So we know who's here. And what we're in fact doing, though, is making them fear the police and the government, which is just the opposite of what the government says it wants to do.
Fear of their government brings thousands of immigrants to the United States every year. It was what brought the woman outside Elizabeth and her brother to the U.S. 14 years ago. Now, as she described her brother's predicament, she said she was afraid again. She was afraid to speak out about her brother's situation. She wore large, oversized dark glasses that concealed her face from the security guards in the jails.
She's here. My mom lives with him now.
And then, as we spoke, one of the guards approached.
Yep. Yeah?
What are you doing?
I'm interviewing people about their friends that they're coming to visit here in detention.
I don't think you could do this on our property, though. You have to have a special permission to come in here and interview anybody while you're on this premises.
After the interruption, I tried to pick up where we left off. There were many unanswered questions. How long did her brother expect to be held? What would he do if he were deported? But as we spoke, her daughter's eyes darted anxiously from the microphone in my hand to the security guard who lingered nearby.
I don't want to read my brother's name. I don't want to mine either.
I wanted to learn more.
Okay, that's
what it is. Thank you.
But the interview is over. I'm Noah Reibel.
And you are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, Arundhati Roy and Howard Zinn. Stay with us.
I see my little baby sisters and brothers barely from under their baby covers, doing time for the crimes of others in correctional institutions with incorrect solutions. What death row?
You are listening to Democracy Now! The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Right now, a conversation between two of the preeminent social critics of our time. One of them, born in Shillong, India, 1959. She studied architecture in New Delhi, where she now lives, and has worked as a film designer, actor, screenplay writer. Her first novel, The God of Small Things, won the prestigious Booker Prize. The other, born in Brooklyn in 1922. His parents, Jewish immigrants who worked in factories. He worked in a shipyard and was a bombardier in World War II. In 1960, he decided to try to write a new kind of history of the United States, a view from the ground up, from the immigrant workers who built this country. He spent the next two decades researching and writing. In 1980, he published his history, and beyond all expectations, it became a bestseller. A little while ago, he sold the millionth copy of this history book. His book is called People's History of the United States. I'm talking about Arundhati Roy and Howard Zinn. Several weeks ago, they had a conversation in front of thousands of people at Riverside Church in Harlem. It was an event sponsored by the Center for Economic and Social Rights and the Lannan Foundation. This is Arundhati Roy and Howard Zinn.
One of the reasons for the acceptance of the war by so many Americans, or not as many Americans as they would like us to think, but the acceptance of the war by a good number of Americans, is that the American population has had concealed from it the human consequences of what we've been doing. It's all been presented as a kind of antiseptic operation. And the bombing of Iraq, just like the bombing of Afghanistan before, like all bombings, really, are presented as something that really doesn't do anything to human beings. And I think of that really through the prism of my own experience, because I was a, you probably know this, Arundhati, and my close friends know it because I never let them forget this. But I was in the Air Force, and I was a bombardier in the Air Force, and I did not know what I was doing. I did not know what was happening to people down there. So when I see these pilots coming back from their missions in Iraq, or as they did in Afghanistan, and they're smiling and they're happy and we hit our targets, it reminds me of myself and how flying at 30,000 feet you drop bombs and you don't hear any screams and you don't see any blood. You don't see kids with dismembered limbs. That's the way modern warfare is carried out. And what happened to me is that I didn't understand the human consequences of what I was doing as a bombardier until I read John Hersey's book, Hiroshima, right after the war. And he went into Hiroshima and he talked to survivors. And you can imagine what those survivors were like. They were people without legs, without arms, people who were blinded, people whose skin was something you could not bear to look at. And he described that. And for the first time, I thought, oh, this is what happens when you bomb.
And President Truman said that the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki was the greatest thing in history.
That's right. And he also said, he said also that we have just bombed a military target. And I try to remind people when I'm talking to audiences in the United States that when they hear Rumsfeld and what did you call him? The Prince of Darkness. Yes. When they hear Rumsfeld explain casually, how, well, an accident took place here and an accident took place there. Yes, these people were killed. These people in the marketplace were killed. But these are accidents because we only bomb military targets. And as you say, Hiroshima was a military target. Dresden was a military target. Tokyo was a military target when 100,000 people were killed in one night of bombing in Tokyo. And the definition of military targets is something, that we must remind people about.
But isn't it interesting how, Saving Private Ryan is so kind of detailed with the blood and the gore and the stumps and the everything. The fiction is so real and reality is so absent. Real wars don't seem to be fought anymore according to TV.
I was particularly annoyed by Saving Private Ryan. because I've been annoyed often in my life, you see, and especially when World War II is paraded before us again and again and again to glorify war, to take sort of that element of morality that there was truly in World War II, the fight against fascism and so on, but one that's been much exaggerated. But to take World War II and to take the element of morality in World War II and to take that the glow that World War II still casts on all of us, except me, and to take that glow and to cast it over all these ugly wars that we have fought since World War II. I resent using World War II, in that way, because, and very often I think, This was the good war, right? In quotation marks. So this is the best of wars. But when you examine it closely, when you examine the consequences of it, you know, it seems to me you must ask yourself, okay, this is the best of wars. And at the end of it, 50 million people are dead. And has war ended? Has fascism ended in the world? Well, we're seeing some of it in this country now. You know, has militarism ended in the world? And so I'm sorry you brought up Saving Private Ryan, because it always leads to this burst of indignation. But I think we need to think not only about the Iraq War, but about war in general, about war, period, and decide that we have reached that point in human history where we cannot tolerate the mass killing of people for whatever cause is presented to us. So, I know I'm supposed to ask you questions. But I'm wondering about your patriotism, you know. And I'm wondering about whether you face the same problem that we do in the United States when we criticize the war or criticize the Bush administration, you know, and we're accused of being un-American and unpatriotic and so on. And
well, I get it both ways. I'm accused of being anti-American and anti-Indian. So, you know, it's a very, you know, when you live outside of America, I'm always brought up short by the racism of, or the racist response to a racist war, you know, because the wars on Iraq and Afghanistan are seen as racist wars. People find it so easy to just hate Americans. And I, whom all the time vilified for being anti-American, am always in the extraordinary position of defending Americans and defending British people and saying, look, if India and Pakistan were fighting a war, I don't think 100,000 people would show up on the streets to protest, you know? It's always like about 9 of us or something.
It's interesting the way you're defending America by pointing to the people who are America, who represent the best ideals of America, and not the worst. And you know, and I think this is what very often people lose, and I suppose they do the same thing with India as an abstraction, you know. And when people, and I've been accused of being anti-American, and I respond to that, you know, by saying, you don't, you know, we must disagree about what America is. America is not Bush. America is not, you know, America, you know, and, you know, America is not the government. And, you know, we must look at the basic principles of democracy. We must look at the Declaration of Independence, you know, which is the fundamental philosophy of democracy. And it says governments are artificial creations. Governments are set up by the people to ensure certain rights, equality, life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness. When governments become destructive of those ends, I'm now quoting the Declaration of Independence, when governments become, if it doesn't mind, when governments become destructive of those ends, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish the government. You see. And if you, you know, and if you have the right to alter or abolish the government, you certainly have the right to criticize the government, you know. But so, it's, you know, the government is being anti-American when it goes against the principles of democracy. You know, that's how I feel about it. So I know I know, Arundhati, that you are pro-Indian in the best sense, and you are pro-American in the best sense. Yeah.
I try not to think in these categories, actually. You know, yeah. I was in Porto Alegre in January, and a lady asked me to sign a petition against the war in Iraq, and I signed it, and it said name organization, and I wrote Arundhati Roy, SIN, which stands for the Sweethearts International Network. So I'm actually not a nationalist of any kind, you know. I believe that I think it's very important to stop our minds coming up short against these artificial boundaries. And I think nationalism really does lie at the root of a lot of the troubles of this century and the last one. Mm. And we really need to question that. Mm. Because
I think one of the ways to remind people of the dangers of nationalism is to ask people if they believe that all people everywhere have an equal right to life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness, not just Americans, but everybody, everywhere in the world. And I think most people would agree. And most people would agree that everybody, and ask people if they believe that children, that the lives of children in Iraq are equal to the lives of children in the United States or in Russia or in China, you see. And if that is so, if all children everywhere have an equal right to life, then war becomes impossible, because war is always a war against children. And so, you know, and sometimes when people bring up, you know, there are still, most people in the United States still defend the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. You know, it's troublesome to think that, but most people in the United States still, because, you know, they've been misinformed, they've been miseducated, they don't really, you know what the situation was at that time. And also they aren't thinking in a certain way about the human race. And I ask people very often if that, when that issue comes up, after we've exhausted all the political and military arguments about what was happening in August of 1945, I said, well, look, if in August of 1945 you knew that we could end the war quickly by killing 100,000 American children, yeah, would you agree? Well, we know what answer people would give. Of course not. Then would you? Why would we agree to kill 100,000 Japanese children in order to speed the end of the war? You know, and I think the nationalism that you talk about, I think, you know, when we put it in terms of human beings everywhere, you know.
But the fact is that, you know, when Madeleine Albright was asked about the death of 500,000 Iraqi children, she said she thought the price was worth it. And the trouble is that, you know, when you live in a country like India, all the time you are faced with the horrors of living in a feudal society where people do believe that some of them are more equal than others. And, you know, I mean, there is the whole issue of race and colonialism, and I mean, it is something that all of us need to ask ourselves very, very seriously. But the fact is that it is true today that you know, if you kill 200,000 Iraqis or you kill 200,000 Afghans, or you kill 200,000 Indians, or you kill 4 million people in the Congo is not the same thing as 200,000 Americans or 200,000 British people or 200,000 Europeans, you know. This is the truth. This is the way it is just now.
And I think, and you pointed to the 10 million or more people who on February 15th demonstrated all around the world against the war, and it must mean that there are huge, huge numbers of people around the world who recognize that. And I just want to say one more thing before I stop saying things, and that is that, which connects with that whole, that wonderful day of enormous solidarity, international solidarity, brotherhood, sisterhood, human beings together that day. And there was, surprisingly, in the New York Times, the day after, a reporter said, some of you may have read this, the reporter said, talking about those demonstrations, said there are now two superpowers in the world, the United States and world public opinion. And I thought, Arundhati, it might be nice for you to read something, which I think I heard you read, which I would like you to read just for my benefit.
It's just going to be a minute. This is the end of an essay called "The Ladies Have Feelings, So Shall We Leave It to the Experts?" It's really an essay in defense of passion, but this is just about, you know, the role of writers and so on. What is happening to the world lies at the moment just outside the realm of common human understanding. It is the writers, the poets, the artists, the singers, the filmmakers who can make the connections, who can find ways of bringing it into the realm of common understanding, who can translate cash flow charts and scintillating boardroom speeches into real stories about real people with real lives, stories about what it's like to lose your home, your land, your job, your dignity, your past and your future to an invisible force, to someone or something you can't see, you can't hate, you can't even imagine. It's a new space that's been offered to us today, a new kind of challenge. It offers opportunities for a new kind of art, an art which can make the impalpable palpable, make the intangible tangible, and the invisible visible. An art which can draw out the incorporeal adversary and make it real, bring it to book. Cynics say that real life is a choice between the failed revolution and the shabby deal. I don't know, maybe they're right, but even they should know that there's no limit to just how shabby that shabby deal can be. What we need to search for and find, what we need to hone and perfect into a magnificent shining thing is a new kind of politics. Not the politics of governance, but the politics of resistance, the politics of opposition, the politics of forcing.
Arundhati Roy, along with Howard Zinn at Riverside Church in Manhattan. That does it for the show Democracy Now!, produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Sharif Abdul-Qudus, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, with help from Noah Reibel and Mike DeFilippo, our engineer, help from Rich Kim. I'm Amy Goodman.